This is The End User, episode 152 for Tuesday, November 5th. Clippy helps. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. And
Taylor, we took a week off in the middle of there since we did the delayed broadcast for the iPad announcement. But we're back in the saddle and we're ready to get back to our regular schedule.
I spent the whole downtime just reading reviews of the new iPad Air, the iPad Mini, the MacBook Pro, the other MacBook Pro, and OS X Mavericks.
Yeah, you've been using Mavericks for a little bit now. What do you think?
It's great. I mean, it's made my computer faster and more energy efficient, and not too many bugs so far. I've run into a few bits of incompatibility, but that's to be expected with any new release. You know, it's mainly third-party developers have trouble keeping up.
Yeah, it happens. It happens. Well, so the big news this week is the Nexus 5 has been released from Google, and all of the details have been released.
Yeah, this phone has been expected for a long time, and we haven't talked about it much on the show because we don't like to report unsubstantiated claims. But I read an article which was really telling. Earlier in the day before Google made the announcement, nearly every tech blog wrote a post that said, this is what Google's going to announce later today, and they were all exactly right.
Yeah, so stuff gets leaked. So that's okay. But yeah, before they're actually substantiated, we don't like to talk about it on the podcast. So now we have real details and a real phone that you can actually put down cash for right now. And that's when we want to talk about it.
All right. So the Nexus 5 is a 4.95-inch display that's running 1080p. So it's something like 441 pixels per inch. And it's going to be sold for $349 off contract. So that's the full price of the phone. It's a really good price for what they're marketing as a full flagship phone. It's got LTE. It's got, you know, great hardware. It's got a good Snapdragon chip. And I don't know. What do you think of this, Chris?
So it's a cool looking device. I mean, for $350, you really cannot beat this. This is a near top-end Android device, and it's got the Snapdragon 800 chip and 2 gig of RAM inside of it with a 1080p screen. It's a little larger than I'm comfortable with, but I'm sure I'd get used to it if I started using it. And it's got a 8-megapixel camera on the back. It's 8.6 millimeters thick. And, you know, for $350, this is like half the price that this thing should be off contract. So I'm sure Google is counting on the fact that by using Android, you are contributing to their search business. So I'm sure it's not really subsidized in the traditional carrier sense of subsidy, but it's kind of subsidized by the fact that you will use Google services in the future in some regard. So I don't know. The phone looks pretty good. The camera's a little smaller than I thought it would be. It's 8 megapixel, but we've gotten over that, right? 8 megapixels is just fine.
Yeah, well, my phone has 8 megapixels. It's not the megapixels that matter.
Yeah, and so they've also got the image stabilization built into the hardware. So it's one of these little cameras that has a little bubble in it so that the sensor is not as sensitive to, you know, shaking your hand and stuff like that. So that's kind of cool. So as far as the phone is designed, I kind of like their minimalist, super simple design aesthetic. What do you think of the look of the thing?
I like it. It is super simple. I like that they've tried to refine it and minimalize it as much as possible. It's a better look than the Nexus 4. I'm not a huge fan of plastic covers for phones, and this thing is really, it's glass on the front and plastic everywhere else.
Yeah, and that's one thing that they've deviated from their last Nexus device, that they are plastic on the back instead of glass on the back. But I don't know, it makes the device lighter. I don't really mind it. I guess this thing's 130 grams, and it's going to feel a little bit lighter, kind of similar to how the Samsung phones feel lighter because they're plastic. So I don't really mind that. They've got the soft touch plastic, which is kind of nice. My 8X also has the same kind of soft touch, slick plastic that's not that candy coated kind of plastic. So I don't think that's too bad. So what is a little bit disappointing, for me at least, particularly for me, and only for Americans who use Verizon, is that the LTE is for... So first of all, the phone is unlocked when you buy it for $350, and the LTE bands are compatible with AT&T, T-Mobile, and Sprint. But Verizon is nowhere to be seen for whatever reason. And it's likely they could absolutely use the LTE data on the phone if you have a SIM card that's compatible, but no guarantees on the CDMA voice side of that. So I don't know what Verizon's waiting for, but I guess they're still testing it, is the word. So I'd have to imagine if we're going to see that eventually happen, but right out of the gate here in launch, it's not happening.
Well, still, to have three of the four carriers in the U.S. is pretty impressive right at launch.
Yeah, well, you of course, remember the days where that never happened with any device. What used to happen, what we're seeing a little bit of a deviation from here, is that the carriers would order the phone, and each carrier would have this weird version of the phone that wasn't quite the same as the other ones, and they'd, you know, put their logo on it and that kind of thing. And I'm glad to see that the Nexus, as it's been doing in the past, is bucking that trend.
Well, I mean, it's an unlocked phone. It's up to Google. And if the carriers want it, they have to play by Google's rules. They're not going to be able to sell it themselves. Although I think T-Mobile is going to. But T-Mobile's whole marketplace idea is that they're just selling you the phone without any strings.
So also on board, we've got Android 4.4 KitKat, and that's got a bunch of kind of small optimizations in Android. They've changed the aesthetic a little bit. It seems to be more geared toward these larger phones that have been all the rage these days. And they've changed it so that when you swipe to the left, you get Google Now right off the bat there. It kind of reminds me of how iOS used to do the Spotlight integration.
Yeah, well, you used to swipe left for Spotlight integration, and now you swipe down in iOS.
Yeah, it's a little bit different now. Now you put your thumb down in the middle and drag the whole thing down, and then you get the little search box, right?
Yeah, I mean, it just makes it more accessible. You can access it from any screen instead of just the leftmost screen.
Yeah, so Google Now is... So I'm being on Windows Phone, that's the one thing that I can look at Android devices and say I'm actually jealous of. And I guess you over there on iOS, you can use an app for it. Do you have the app?
Yeah, I have the Google app. I use Google Now a lot. It's amazing at the things that it knows I want to see. So it knows which sports teams I like without me ever having to tell it. And when there's a current game on and I'm not able to watch it, I can just open up the Google app, check out my cards, and see how they're doing.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And the rest of KitKat is kind of minor. It's like tweaks here and there. There's not any like groundbreaking features that are in this new version of Android. They've kind of tweaked the edges and really optimized the experience and, just kind of fixed up the little corners of the user experience that were a little rough. One thing that people are complaining a little bit about is the camera application. So matched with this 8-megapixel camera, which is a little bit spotty, the camera application apparently in the new KitKat OS is still not quite up to snuff, at least compared with iOS. And I'd even throw a Windows Phone in there. The Nokia devices have pretty nice cameras on them, and even my 8X has a decent camera app, even though the camera is just about on par with this. But the Google camera app seems to lag behind a little bit.
Yeah, Apple really put a lot of work into improving the user experience of their camera app with iOS 7, so it's surprising the elements of the system that Google doesn't really put so much effort into. And they're not trying to create a streamlined user experience. But in other ways, you know, with Google Now, with all of the hardware optimizations that they've made with KitKat, they're working really hard and they're creating an amazing operating system. One other thing that I'm worried about, though, is in the Nexus 5, apparently, all of your calling and text messaging goes through your Hangouts app. And it sounds like this is going to be the case with all of all the KitKat devices. Your messaging app will be replaced by Hangouts. And so all of your Google Chats will be combined with your text messages, except even in the Hangouts app, they're kept in separate strings.
Yeah, that's a little weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very weird. It sounds like they really just wanted to push you into Hangouts, and they didn't quite think about how that would affect people who use both every day.
Yeah, I think they were going for the simple integration. Say, okay, we've got these two streams, but they represent the same kind of communication. And they tried to push it into one app. But the distinction between text and instant message is actually kind of important. So I'm not sure that that's the time and place to do that.
Yeah, it's strange because you would think that the reason is simplicity and integration, but you can't just take two apps and turn them into one app and call it simple and integrated.
And from simplicity is born complexity. Because it really is simpler, right? It's just that sometimes you run into the edges of it. And anytime you run into the edge of it, it's not a good experience.
I don't know. I don't see how it's simpler at all in this particular case. Hangouts is already becoming bloated, I think. This week, they also announced that Hangouts for all platforms have full text messaging support. So I guess that makes sense with the difference. But then they also have location sharing and animated GIFs in line.
Yeah, Hangout has started to integrate a bunch of that kind of stuff to go in line. That's been true on the web for a while now. So they're bringing that same kind of change down to the device side of things. So lastly, another note outside of the Nexus 5, HTC is saying that all of their One series of devices, which is ridiculous to say, are going to get the KitKat update within 90 days of the release. So they've got 90 days from a couple days ago here.
Yeah, that's right. I'm impressed that HTC is focused so much on getting these updates out. They used to be all about the Sense overlay software, and they really wanted to get Sense right to the point where they weren't too worried about the new releases that Google was doing. So the fact that they are moving to get all of their flagship devices updated as soon as possible is a nice thing to hear.
Yeah, so we've got a question there in the chat room from Canadian Geek. He's saying, are the messages in the Hangouts marked differently between the Hangout message and the SMS message? And apparently, if you believe the Verge article, what happens is you can start a Hangout with somebody, and then if you start text messaging with them, then it creates kind of a new instance of the stream of communication. So they're kind of integrated, but then they're kind of separate in the same app. So it's really bizarro land. So they're going to fix that over time. That sounds just too weird to actually stay around.
And it looks like the way that you can tell the difference is in your list of message strings, the contact icon of the person that you're talking to, if you're talking to them over SMS, they'll have a little SMS notification on top of their picture, which is a really strange way to do it.
Yeah, so I don't know how that one's going to shake out, but it's definitely confusing for now. All right, well, I think we just about covered everything on that. Shall we get a little excited, have a cup of coffee, and turn on the afterburners?
Sure, let me get my seatbelt on now. Seatbelt in one hand, coffee in the other, beer in the other hand. All right, I'm ready to go.
Okay, and are you ready to take off in an airplane?
I am ready, but I will not be putting down my phone, that's for sure. So as a response to an advisory panel, which had recommended pulling back electronic restrictions, the Federal Aviation Administration is starting to allow airlines to let people use their devices during the entirety of the flight, and you're supposed to have them away during takeoff and landing, but as soon as the plane is off the ground, you can use it. And now this has already been put into effect on certain JetBlue and Delta flights.
Yeah, and they're saying you're still not allowed to be on the phone or use data, but you can have your device out and powered on. So
yeah, it has to be in airplane mode. But
any device under 2 pounds, like a Kindle, you can have out and use it, although you can't use the data or anything. So that's one step in the right direction, I think.
Crap, my iPad 4 with a keyboard case is more than 2 pounds. Does that mean I can't use it?
Yeah, you know, there's a blurry line there, because aren't the smaller MacBook Airs around that size?
Yeah, they're right around 2 pounds.
Yeah, so I bet you an iPad would be okay and a MacBook Air would not. That would be, if I had to guess.
It still seems like a spurious distinction to me.
Yeah, it kind of is, isn't it? Well, so Google keeps moving right along with its latest release of Chrome. They've got a new feature in the Canary build, which, if you remember, is the latest bleeding edge release to the public of Chrome. And they've added some kind of smart malware detection into the downloading UI. So if you go and try to download a known malicious executable of some sort, it will say that is malicious, and Chrome will block it. So you do not download the file, and all you get is a dismiss button. So I think that's a pretty big user win, and it seems like a pretty nice protection to have. So I'm waiting for it to come into the stable channel of Chrome, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Another way that Google is moving on is they finally said goodbye to iGoogle, their personalized start page. We've known about this for a long time. We have talked about it on the show before, and we've offered alternatives, but it's gone now. If you were still using it, sorry, but you were warned.
Yeah, and I know Richard from the DMZ, I think, still use iGoogle, if I'm not mistaken. So I'll be curious to see what he's going to move to. I think we mentioned NetVibes as a possible replacement. And for Chrome, there's another plugin called, or extension called, Awesome New Tab Page that has a lot of those same kind of features. So unfortunate to see. I didn't use iGoogle, but it's still unfortunate to see it go, considering I know that some people out there on the web have been using it for a long time now.
So Nintendo has stopped manufacturing their Wii in place of the Wii U, but they are still making the Wii Mini, which came out in Canada and the UK over the past year, and it is now available in the US. It cannot connect to the internet. It only plays Wii optical discs, and it is only $100. If you are looking for that, I would suggest looking somewhere else.
Yeah, there's got to be somebody who will buy this, but I don't know. Not anyone I know. So Dell has officially gone private with their founder, Michael Dell, and Silver Lake Partners. The transaction to buy the company back is around $24.9 billion. So I guess they're getting off the publicly traded company treadmill, as it were. So will this allow them to innovate a little better and a little more quickly, perhaps? Only time will tell.
Meanwhile, BlackBerry's plan to go private, the takeover by private equity firm Fairfax, has been canceled. And now they are taking on $1 billion in debt in order to float the company for a while, and have also decided to get rid of their CEO.
Yes, that was bizarre. I was under the impression that this deal was nearly final, but I guess it fell apart.
I guess so, yeah. I have no idea what's going to happen to BlackBerry in the future. They are in the deep end.
Yeah. So LastPass has released an update to its plugin. If you have listened to the podcast before, you know that we often recommend something like LastPass. And in fact, LastPass is the one that I use. So they've got their 3.0 version of the plugin that's out. They've got a redesigned UI. All the kind of UI elements are in the same place, but they kind of tidied everything up. Looks like they gave it a new skin. And they also added a handful of features. So the biggest feature is just the autofiller. So if you have multiple accounts on a website, when it goes to autofill the password, it actually gives you a little indicator that you have multiple accounts that you can log into in the actual login box as opposed to up in the right where the plugin is. So that can be pretty handy. I've got multiple accounts for the same websites, and I've run into this already, and it seems pretty nice. So there's a bunch of other kind of aesthetic changes that they've got going on here. And if you want to see the full list, then go to the link in our show notes talking about LastPass.
Cool. Well, I probably won't switch to LastPass. I've been a vocal proponent of 1Password, the Mac-centric competitor to LastPass. But I've been trying out iCloud Keychain, and it's working pretty well so far, at least in combination with 1Password.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty decent solution from as much as we talked about it. All right, so let's turn off the afterburners, sit back, relax, and enjoy a hot cider as we get into the end user stories. I guess it's that time of year.
Well, don't sip too fast because it's time for our end user public service announcement.
Yes, and this is kind of surprising news to me. There's been word. Remember, we talked about this when it first happened, and I was, in fact, on the list of people whose passwords have been leaked into the hacker public, as it were. And
right.
This...
So Adobe leaked a bunch of passwords because they were the victim of a sustained hacking attack. And so the hackers were able to gain access to a password database. Adobe announced this in a press release. They said, don't worry, our encryption is secure. And you read up on it at the time. You read what Adobe said, and you agreed with them. Adobe encryption secure. Not a problem. Now, that turned out not to be the case quite.
Yeah, not quite. And depending on a couple other factors here, it's not like the LinkedIn attack. You remember, they leaked their passwords and there was no encryption whatsoever. But what happened here is they chose the wrong kind of cryptography. So they chose to encrypt their passwords with a triple DES cipher. And triple DES is an encryption cipher. It's not a hashing algorithm. So when you are looking to store your passwords, you want to use a function that makes it so that the password that you hash is completely non-reversible. So you're turning this password into a bunch of gobbledygook, and it's completely not reversible ever. And then when somebody goes to log in, you take their password and you hash it again and you compare the values to see if the password is correct. And that's not what they did here. And that is an industry best practice. I can't tell you how dull it is to not do that in this day and age. And I'm guessing they had some kind of legacy system problem, and for some reason all of their accounts were dealt in this manner. Now, all of this said, at least it was encrypted, even if it was encrypted in the wrong way. So this thing is vulnerable to brute force attacks at this point, and eventually, sometime in the future, they will undoubtedly be decrypted. So it's not to say that you are in any immediate danger, and hopefully you're using unique passwords per site using something like LastPass or Taylor's iCloud solution there. But this is just not the way to do it. And it's really frustrating for me to look out at the industry and look at all the companies that have our precious details and are just being cowboys with it. So Adobe didn't do this correctly. You remember LinkedIn didn't do this correctly, famously. And it's frustrating looking out there and giving them the key to my account that I have with them. And they're just not treating it correctly. That's just very frustrating to me.
Yeah, there's not too much that they can do at this point. I mean, the encrypted file is available on BitTorrent easily.
Yeah, so what this does do is opens up the simpler passwords to be cracked. So if your password was monkey, you've probably already been outed. But if you had a longer, more secure password, then you probably haven't been outed yet.
But it's only a matter of time.
Yes, it is only a matter of time. So if you have an Adobe account, and particularly if it has the same password, you really ought to go change it on Adobe's site and any other website that you have used that password with. So this is particularly bad. Like I said, not as bad as it could be. You're probably safe for a little while, but This will undoubtedly be cracked eventually. So don't panic, but that happened, and it's frustrating.
Yes. Yes, it is.
All right. Well, let's move on. I recently underwent a pretty big change in my online life, and I wanted to talk about it, see if you had any questions about it, Taylor. I've migrated from Gmail to Outlook.com with my custom domain.
What?
Yes.
No way.
So I must have been using Gmail for something on the order of 10 years at this point. When did you get Gmail first?
You told
me about it.
I remember trying to game an invitation into Gmail back when it was still in private beta. The rollout was very slow, so at one point, Gmail users would only have something like 5 invites to send to people. And before that, it was just basically a completely closed beta. And eventually, they upped it to 50, but somewhere in between those two, when it was still in private invite beta, I managed to convince a stranger on the internet to to give me a code.
Yeah, so I'm...
So I've been using Gmail for it's probably almost 10 years at this point.
Yeah, it's pretty close. I looked at the last message in my inbox, and it was from 2006. So that's at least when I first started actually archiving the email from my Gmail. So anyway, I have moved away. And by the way, Gmail is a completely different application now than it used to be. But so I have migrated all my mail, all about 20,000 messages over to Outlook.com, and I'm still using the custom domain that is Barnesian.com. And I've switched my website provider from Google's Blogger over to WordPress. And you may be sensing a theme here. Basically, I had Google Apps running on Barnesian.com, and I wanted to move away from that since they're killing off the free option. I wanted to move to something that that A, had less lock-in, and B, was still free. And I know that I was grandfathered, but I wanted to kind of move proactively over to something that I know would be sustainable for a long time to come. And Outlook.com is really the only email provider out there now that allows you to use them as a back end and use your own domain as your email address. So just some impressions from Outlook.com. You know, I had played around with a little bit before with my Microsoft account, but now that I've gotten to use it full time, I'm actually really liking it. I think if you are only looking at the web application part of Outlook versus Gmail, I think Outlook wins hands down. So one of the things that I was really impressed with, and this is a small thing. I realize this is a tiny little blip on the radar, but so I've migrated all of my mail over POP to the new Outlook account, and so I had a bunch of unread messages in my inbox. In fact, nearly 20,000 of them.
Hang on, you migrated over POP? Gross.
Yeah gross. No, it's a decent way to just migrate the mail. You know, I wouldn't use it for actual usage day to day. I'd use IMAP, but to just purely make a copy, it's actually a pretty decent way. Took a couple days though. So
wow.
I ticked the little box that is the select all box, and Outlook.com prompted me and they said, "Oh, would you like to select all items in your inbox?" Because what I wanted to do was mark them all as read. So I could go from having freshly imported my mail and having them unread and marking all of them as read. And that turned out to be as painless as 2 or 3 clicks. And I am not sure to this day how I would go about doing that in Gmail.
Did a little paperclip pop up and said, "It looks like you're trying to mark all of your mail as read. Would you like some help with that?"
No, it was a little claymation Einstein.
Ah, right. I remember the Einstein. The puppy was my favorite.
Yeah, the puppy was cool too. Yeah, so...
So...
Go ahead.
I have one question, and you said that you were worried about being locked into Gmail and Google services, but Google has been pretty famously transparent in allowing you to get your information out of Google and transfer it to some other service. They still keep your information and probably sell ads with it, but they let you take it and move somewhere else. And it sounds like you were able to do that fairly easily here. So what was the concern about being locked into Gmail that you had?
So my objection is not really with the Google account per se. So if you have an @gmail.com address, that's not where my objection lies, because they are pretty good about that. In fact, during the migration, I was able to move over my Google Voice, Google Plus, not YouTube, but most of the Google properties that I was using, I was able to move over to a new account fairly painlessly. But since I was using the Google Apps with the custom domain, and they registered the domain on my behalf with GoDaddy, then to migrate that domain away from Google Apps proved to be quite difficult, because I had to turn off domain privacy for a short period of time. And it turns out that Google had signed me up for GoDaddy, and GoDaddy had signed me up for domainsbyproxy.com. And they used an email that no longer exists, so I no longer had the proper credentials to get out of that domains by proxy account. So in the end, I had to email my passport photo to domains by proxy so that they would unlock my account for me.
Oh, wow.
So that proved to be a lot more difficult than I thought it was going to be. But that is the nature of when you sign up for services that sign you up for services that sign you up for services with an email that no longer exists. So that whole process was really wacky, but once I got control of that account, and by the way, I guess if you email a passport photo to that website, that they will in fact unlock an account for you. I don't know. That policy seems a little weak to me, but migrating that part of the Google Apps away and into Namecheap and WordPress and other services that match the existing Google services proved to be a little bit more difficult than I would have thought.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it.
Whew. But it's over. I'm good. I'm on WordPress now for my website. You can go have a look at it at Barnesian.com, of course. And I'm pretty happy with where I ended up. I've got a Google account. I've got the same email with my new account, but it's at it's still the custom domain, but it's at outlook.com, which is nice. So I'm pretty happy with how everything ended up.
I still have my domain email being handled by my web server, just using their default email services, but mostly everything just gets forwarded to my other personal account so that I can use Gmail or whatever.
Yeah, and that makes sense. So, well, technically, I guess I've still got a Gmail account, but it's not going to be my primary email going forward here. And the user experience on Outlook.com is, in my opinion, far superior to what Gmail is putting up right now. So I'm glad for the move. So it's still kind of settling in. It's still a little new. You know, it's been the case for under 2 weeks at this point. So we'll see how it settles in. But I'm liking it so far.
All right. Well, our tip of the week will cover some Gmail and other email service search tips. So we'll get to that in a couple of minutes.
But before first,
we do, I want to talk about the green tech story of the week.
Yeah, so what do we got here?
All right, so this is back to the bleeding edge of solar power research. I keep coming back to this, but there keep being new developments, and this is really cool. All right, so first a primer on solar panels. The way solar photovoltaic panels are currently made is they take silicon, sheets of it, using as little as possible to still maintain that solar charge, and they dope it with certain chemicals that allow electrons to bump off the orbital plane and form a current that creates a direct current off the cell, which if you connect enough of the cells in series, you get a usable electrical current. Now, we use so much silicon for this and for other things that it's starting to get really expensive. And as far as turning sunlight into electricity goes, it's not particularly efficient. Now, you're still getting free power from sunlight, so that's plenty efficient enough. But some researchers have found a new plentiful substance, a natural mineral called perovskite that has a higher efficiency at capturing light and conductivity. So with a standard solar panel, in production, they've gotten it up to about 5% efficiency from converting sunlight into electricity. Now, just preliminary experiments using solar panels made of perovskite have yielded efficiencies of 15%, and they can probably bring it up even higher than that with refined manufacturing processes. So there's this cheap, abundant material that was already around and probably will be expensive in the long run. But right now we have this new material that's going to make better solar panels, and it's cheaper to procure than silicon.
Cool. And I know with some of the silicon-based solar cells of years past, they've gotten efficiencies that are far greater than 5%. But
They happen to use
super rare elements, and
that's not really sustainable. It depends on what element you use to dope the silicon. But the nice thing about this perovskite is that you can essentially use it as is. I mean, you have to refine it, obviously, but you don't have to dope it.
Yeah, so you're getting a higher efficiency that we could achieve before, but we're using a more abundant material. So yeah, that's a pretty big win if this does turn out to actually come to life and we can actually scale it into real production. And that sounds cool.
Yeah, so we have a question in the chat room. Is traditional solar power 5% efficient, and this is 15% efficient? It's a hard question to answer, and it doesn't even tell you the whole story anyway, because the efficiency that they're measuring is how much sunlight are you turning into electricity. So it's given the amount of space that you have for panels, how efficient can you be with the amount of sunlight that you're getting in that space? And so at that rate, the standard...
Yeah, the typical one.
The typical manufactured solar panel out there is around 5 to 10% right now. Preliminary laboratory results with this new material came out to 15%, and we may be able to get it higher than that if and when it reaches production.
Right, and the question is can it scale? Can we make this in large quantities? If it can, then it'll be a good replacement.
Probably by the time we're making this in large quantities, the materials will start to become more valued, and we may even run into a shortage, which has happened in certain markets with silicon, but it's still more efficient just based on preliminary testing. So it's a good thing, and you may see perovskite-based solar cells in your neighborhood in the future.
Cool. So we talked about LastPass in the last part of the afterburners there, but we've got a real app pick coming your way. What do you have for us, Mr. Marr?
All right. So this has to do with... email, and specifically it's a better way to search multiple email inboxes. This is an Android and iOS app called Cloud Magic, and it's pretty cool. They must be doing some really cool server-side magic because you can search multiple inboxes and it searches in real time as you type and gives you the results pretty quickly. I tried this out, and it's much better than my built-in mail app on my iPhone, because mail would only give me real-time search of the messages that are still held on local memory. But Cloud Magic searches everything and gives you real-time results throughout multiple email inboxes going through your entire archive.
Cool. So they must aggregate some of the data on their servers or something like that.
Yeah, they must. And there must be a lot of back and forth between the app and the servers. So they've got some really powerful server stuff going on. But what it is it just turns the app into a great way to search for a particular email if you don't remember which inbox it was or how long ago you talked about it. Now, my built-in mail app can do this, but what I would have to do is type in the whole phrase and send it and have Google servers send me back the results. And depending on the search, that sometimes takes a while. And if I mistype the search, if I'm not sure exactly what I'm looking for, I have to try new phrases each time and wait each time for the result. So I really like using the built-in apps for mail on my iPhone, but I didn't even realize that I could get a better search solution from a third-party app. And so that's what this is. You can still use whatever email app you were already using, but if you want to search for something and you don't remember where you put it, this is a great app for that.
Yeah, and so it can search across my new Gmail account and my new Outlook.com account. So that's pretty cool. So maybe
right, as well as Google Apps for your domain, if you still use that. Yep. It searches Yahoo, Mail.com, AOL, and any IMAP account.
Yeah, which is pretty much everyone. So that seems pretty cool. I do wonder if they're aggregating your email on their servers or if they're sending the search queries out to each of the providers. So if they're aggregating all of your email onto their servers, we might have some privacy concern. But I'm not sure if they're doing that or not.
Yeah, if they're doing that, they're doing it invisibly. So they haven't asked me for any passwords or anything. So I don't think that they're doing that way. They're probably searching the other servers.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get into our last story of the week. Our kicker, what is glowing in the dark here? This is terrifying.
Ice cream. Ice cream is glowing in the dark.
But why?
All right, well, I guess the beginning of the story is jellyfish. Several species of jellyfish can glow in the dark using a photoluminescent protein that scientists and researchers have been able to synthesize from the jellyfish for several years now, and they've been splicing it into genes in certain other living organisms and also in other non-living materials. So earlier this year, a lab was able to create splice the gene into a rabbit and create glow-in-the-dark bunnies. And now they've taken the same proteins and mixed them in with ice cream. And they're calcium activated, so there's calcium in the ice cream, and it glows when it's agitated. So when it melts or when you lick it or when it reacts to different pHs, it warms up or it's agitated and it glows. So they now are producing glow-in-the-dark ice cream. And you can have it if you're in Britain for the low, low price of 140 British pounds per scoop.
So that's about $225 in American dollars. So it's pretty expensive. I think these scientists are mad with power and need to be stopped.
Right. Well, this isn't a scientist who created the ice cream. This is a food science entrepreneur, I suppose, would be what to call him. But it's perfectly safe. It's just a protein, and it doesn't last all that long, but it's ice cream that glows in the dark, and that's why it's kicker-worthy. I mean, clearly.
All right, well, let's get on out of here for this week. So, Taylor, I heard that you were cheating on me with another podcast.
I wouldn't put it that way. Because if you do, I would like to talk to you about all of the other podcasts that you've been on ever since we started The End User. But no, I was on another Digital Media Zone podcast, Home On, with Richard Gunther. And I had a great time. It's a home automation podcast, as we've mentioned before. And we talked about environmentalism and eco-consciousness and really about saving money in home automation. And even if you haven't gotten into home automation, there is a lot of cool stuff about ways you can save money at home. And so I hope that I did well enough for Richard. I had a lot of fun, and I think it's a really great show.
Yeah.
And so if you are interested in home automation or saving money through tips and tricks, behaviors at home, or if you just want to hear me talk for longer, you should definitely check out this week's episode, episode 12 of Home On.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm a listener of Home On, and I'm looking forward to listening to that one. That's cool. So if somebody wanted to talk to you on the internets at large, perhaps about green home technology, or perhaps about this show, how would they go about doing this?
Well, they could start by buying a Wii Mini.
Oh, no.
Which doesn't connect to the internet, so it's going to be complicated from here. You're going to need a few solar cells. I'm just kidding. I don't even know where to go from there.
Yeah, you backed yourself into a hole.
You can send me an email, taylor@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can tweet at me. I'm at TaylorPhone on Twitter. Or you can, I really prefer Vine. Vine is my medium of choice these days. So just try to sum it up in 6 seconds and make a video.
Cool. So that's pretty good. If you wanted to get at me, I am at Chris Hale Barnes, and I'm always on Twitter. So let me know what you think of the show and that kind of thing. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at the digitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THEND USR. The DMZ has a handful of other podcasts you should have a listen to: Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, The Movie Podcast, and Home On This Week with your guest host Taylor Marr. You can send us some feedback. Our email together is theendusers@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. Together we are at @theendusers. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at around 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Please do not send me home automation and green tech questions on Vine.